I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We often on this program, as you know, over the last 18 years, talk about issues of race and who we are as Americans. And it seems in the last 5 or 6 years, there have been so many phenomenal books that have come out that kind of eat away at our preconceptions and broaden our understanding of what it is to be an American and how the power of the African-American world in defining what it means to be an American, and how that history of race in America is not as simple as we like to think it is. Another one of those books is by Daniel Sharfstein. And Daniel Sharfstein, I joked as he came in today, was we just saw a Sharfstein page between his father and his brother, now him, on this show. But this Daniel Sharfstein, he's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt, went to Harvard and Yale, worked with Gates and at Harvard. We'll talk about that. This book is called The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. And Daniel Sharfstein, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And welcome back to Baltimore.
Thank you.
This is your hometown.
Well, I grew up in Montgomery County.
Montgomery County.
But my whole family is now here.
Right, right. Yep. So your brother's now the Secretary of Health.
Yep.
With the state, and of course your father. I worked with him many years back at Shepherd Pratt, so it's good to meet you.
Thank you.
So this is interesting. This is, before we get into this journey, and this is a journey historically that follows three very distinct families, all of whom began as African-American in this country in the 18th century, and their descendants, for the most part, identify as white and it's that journey. But I'm curious to start with, what led you to this particular, what about your work with Dr. Gates at Harvard and the rest led you to want to go through this journey?
That's a great question. And these are issues that I have been thinking about for almost 20 years since I was in college. And when I was a freshman in college, really at Harvard, first day of school, I wandered into a class on pre-1920 African-American literature, and I sat at a seminar table. It was a small class, and the professor was getting more and more excited talking about the spirituals. Then all of a sudden, he disappeared under the table. Students looked at each other across the table, and then he popped up with a 78 record player, started cranking it, and Paul Robeson's voice filled the room, and I was hooked. And that was a wonderful class and introduced me to a lot of authors I had never heard of before. And the one who really made the biggest impression on me was a man named Charles Chestnut.
Oh, yes.
Who was raised in North Carolina, Fayetteville, North Carolina, and then in Cleveland. He became a lawyer and a court stenographer. He was someone who was proudly African-American, but in everyday life, he was often confused for a white man. And he did things like when Plessy versus Ferguson was decided in 1896, when the Supreme Court held that it was okay to segregate railroad cars, Charles Chestnut decided he'd take a trip and went to Virginia, and he rode the rails through Virginia, having these conversations with conductors while he sat in the white car, asking them, how could you possibly tell if someone was white or black? Are there ever any tough cases? What do you do in those tough cases? And that was something that was very interesting to me. And then actually this precise project really first began to take shape when it was the summer before my senior year in college. And Professor Gates had asked me and several other of my peers to go to South Africa and volunteer on a voter education project. This was the summer of 93, before the country's first free elections. And it was an unbelievable experience for all of us. And we worked with a group of longtime anti-apartheid activists. And one of them said, she had been classified as colored, which was the South African designation for mixed race, but she easily could have been classified as African. And I said, explain, what do you mean? And she said, when the first census was being conducted under the Race Classifications Act in the 50s, a local constable went door to door, essentially classifying everyone. And he knew her father, who had been a police officer, and thought he'd honor their friendship and her father's service by putting a C by their names instead of an A. And that one word, really just one letter, just had a huge effect on her life. She went to a different kind of school. She only spoke English and Afrikaans. She grew up in a different kind of township, in a different house, had a totally different relationship growing up to authority, even though she wound up an anti-apartheid activist. And race in South Africa was supposed to be something that was protected with the full power of a police state. And it was justified in the language of 20th century science. You know, it's supposed to be obvious, inevitable. But here it was a product of personal relationships and community dynamics and even individual whim. And I came back to the U.S. really wondering if the same thing had happened here.
And in a twisted way it had.
Absolutely. I began researching court cases where courts had to determine whether someone was white or black. And there were dozens of these cases, even hundreds, from slavery and segregation. Everywhere that the law distinguished black from white, there was someone who would make a statement in court that this law shouldn't be applied to them because they were being misclassified.
What's interesting in this sojourn you took and these three families that you focus on and wind, you have to – not this, you have an interesting way of writing because you don't write in this kind of linear fashion. You kind of take us on this journey from one chapter to the next. You have to – and this family, the next family, then we go 50 years later and there's another family. And
yep.
But
yep.
Of course, that was by design, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm curious why you wrote the book that way. But these three families, before we get three families, the broader issues of race, that the complexity of race and interracial relationships in the 18th, 17th, and 19th, 18th, and even 17th century in early America was not as simplistic as we think. That's one of the things you discovered in this thing.
Yes.
It was more complex than the usual historical landscape would give us when we read about history.
Yes. There is a sense that race is something that's obvious, that we all know how it works. And, I mean, in a way, that's just a reflection of what race is. You know, it can be a set of rules that are announced by a legislature or a judge, but it's also something that we just live every day. And it's a set of stories that we tell ourselves and retell ourselves. And I think it's just really important to understand just how different the experience of the past can be. So 17th century, when the first Africans came to America, the English settlers had never had slaves before. There were all kinds of ideas about what Africans were like. Historians like Winthrop Jordan have written incredible books about this. But once they were living with Africans, this was a very different experience. And it was unclear what slavery would be. It was unclear if people would be slaves for life. And the nature of tobacco cultivation in Virginia and Maryland in the 17th century, there were so many booms and busts, it was unclear if this would make people rich. So slave owners, European indentured servants, and African slaves were all working, the historian Ira Berlin at the University of Maryland.
He's wonderful. Yeah.
Right? He talks about people working shoulder to shoulder in the fields.
Right.
And there were all kinds of opportunities for Africans to negotiate their way out of slavery. And there were all kinds of other instances of interracial intimacy. So in the 1660s, when Virginia enacted a law that made the status of a child follow maternal status. So the child of a slave mother would be a slave. Child of a free mother would be free.
Right.
This had enormous consequences in African American life. But one of the one of the least intuitive consequences was this was the foundation of the free communities of color in America.
Some very interesting things came out of this book. I mean, it made me think of an article I read a long time ago, and I was desperately trying to find the article this morning before I came in. I couldn't find it, but it was an article that was about that posited that if you are white and trace your ancestry to the south of the United States, and your family was here in the 1800s or 1700s, there was a better than even chance that African blood flowed in your veins.
You know, that for I've read a lot of these articles. Actually,
right.
For a good 100 years, a lot of sociologists have earnestly tried to estimate the number of people who started out as African American and became white, and the percentage of whites with African American ancestry. I mean, it's a really hard thing to measure.
Very hard thing to measure, yeah.
I've seen estimates ranging from 1 to 20% of the white population. It's something, though, that I'm convinced that many, many white Americans, millions even, have this heritage. And what's interesting now is that there's been so much genealogical material that's been posted on the internet and is searchable on the internet. And there's this huge rise in DNA ancestry testing. You know, you swab your cheek,
send it off.
And they tell you you're 12% African American.
Skip Gates is a big part of getting people to do that.
Exactly, exactly. And more and more Americans are discovering this story every day. So one descendant of one of these families who I met and interviewed, she said, every family has its secret. And I think for really millions of Americans, that this is their secret.
It confounds an idea of race and makes it and really makes us wrestle with the thing in a different way. And one of the things that's interesting to me that almost all the people that you interviewed in your book whose families are white in America now but began as black have a really difficult time with the fact that they have African ancestry. Something that's very cool, very few, but for the most part, this is very troubling to them.
Well, I think there was I was very curious to see how people would respond to conversations with me about this. And I wasn't breaking the news to that many people.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, because of these searchable ancestry technologies, they were chewing over this and had been digesting this information for the past 5 years, say, when I met them. And it was just a huge range of emotion, you know, ranging from flat denial to real bitterness and anger about it. One man said he was more racist than he had ever been.
that was Murphy, right?
Right.
Right.
Although his reaction was much more complicated than that, I think he was trying to convince himself that he was white, and I think nothing secures your whiteness more than professing to hate black people. And so he was saying that he was very – had all these racist feelings about this. At the same time, he just couldn't stop researching his family story and couldn't stop posting it on the web. He really wanted this story to be available. And for a lot of people, it actually did give them a connection to American history and gave a meaning to their life that they never had before.
It's almost as if these people who discover that they have African ancestry, that their families began as Africans in America, were in the same turmoil of the love-hate relationship we have in the black-white worlds, but this became an individual struggle rather than a societal struggle.
Yeah, what's really interesting is A lot of people said, and I think maybe this is one of the reasons this was so tough for people to process, is being white these days, even in our post-racial era.
Post-racial?
Yeah.
Sort of post-racial. I don't know if we're really post-racial.
Supposedly post-racial
yeah,
era.
Right.
Being white to some degree means not having to think about race very much.
Exactly.
And people said, you know, before I learned this about my family, you know, whenever there was a news story or a newspaper article that had some African-American angle, I could just kind of tune it out, you know, turn the page and think this didn't have anything to do with me. And I think this literal kinship really forces people to open their eyes to just how central the African-American experience is to the American experience.
Now, these families you traced are fascinating. In some ways, the struggle about how these people who now see themselves as white, discovering that they actually had African-American roots, are interesting, but their ancestors, in some ways, are even more interesting. Mm-hmm. And because it tells us a lot about kind of our history, and each of these families are just fascinating. I mean, let me just go through some of them. I mean, because the way you write the book, and you kind of make us kind of go from family to family and piece of history to piece of history and come mm-hmm. back again. It's like reading a complex novel. You got to remember what you just did a minute ago.
Yep.
And you did that on purpose, didn't you?
Yes.
So why did you write it like that?
Well, you know, race is something that means all kinds of different things depending on how you look at it.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like a crystal. You know, each face refracts the light in a different way. And I chose three families that became white at different times and were in different parts of the South and were becoming white from different social positions, from people who are rich, people who are poor, people who are educated, people who are not. And so I wanted to really give a three-dimensional portrait of what race was and how it changed over time.
And how confusing it was.
Right? Oh, to everybody.
To everybody.
At different moments, absolutely.
Not being able to stand the fact that there were black folks fighting in Western Carolina, and we'll get to that story, mm-hmm. or a slave master who gives his half-white, half-black children away to abolitionists in Ohio but kept the mothers in slavery to people passing because they couldn't stand the discrimination in Washington, D.C., or living up in the mountains and the hills and being able to fudge their way, which I knew because of my sister's area where she lives in West Virginia. There's a lot of people there who you know have African ancestry in her communities, but don't see themselves as black,
right?
To this day, well, you know. So it's.
I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois defined race as this place where a person becomes a problem, and on a larger level, the race question could be very easy to people. You can believe that there's a exacting color line. You can believe that there is a hierarchy of races. But then on a personal level, it's almost always complicated beyond belief.
Unbelievable. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Wall family, the Spencer family, the Gibson family, with Daniel Sharfstein, who's visiting his hometown or close to his hometown here in Baltimore. He's a professor of law at Vanderbilt and has written this amazing book, The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. And as we said earlier in the program, partially inspired by his work as a student at Harvard when he worked with Skip Gates. We'll be back. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are here with Daniel J. Sharfstein. His book is The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. And as soon as you hear this interview, as you're driving around, turn your car towards the Enoch Pratt Free Library downtown, and you can meet him and continue the conversation with him live there at the library this evening. The book is The Invisible Line, Three American Families and the Secret Journey from Black to White. So let's go through these families and where we left them. I mean, they're all just such fascinating characters. So here we have the Gibsons.
Mm-hmm.
A family started by a renegade black man. And then they become, in the coming generations, racist leaders of the Confederacy who want to kill construction and are the racist leaders of their community. Let's talk a bit about the Gibsons.
Sure. So the Gibsons descend from some of the first free people of color in America. They were free in 17th century Virginia. And then in the 1730s, they right when Virginia, there were various points where the legislature was sort of tightening the screws on free people of color and really narrowing their ability to own land, make money.
Love between black and white was getting just a little out of hand for the Virginia,
right.
Virginia power structure.
Right.
Right.
And so these laws, they didn't just fix the status of African Americans as second class people. They actually set African Americans in motion. So a lot of the first free families of Virginia moved into Maryland and Delaware, and then also south into the Carolinas. And in the Carolinas, what the Gibsons found were frontiers that needed settlers. And in a way, frontier life was a little more relaxed, and so they could own land and have a lot of the freedoms that everyone else around them could enjoy. And so they moved to South Carolina, and almost immediately the legislature started debating whether they could stay because they were convinced that this large mixed-race clan had come to the colony, which at the time was majority slave. They had come to – people feared they'd come to foment a slave rebellion. And the governor had a personal audience with them. And afterwards, he declared that the Gibsons were not Negroes nor slaves but free people. He said they were skilled tradesmen, and that mattered a lot. They had owned land in Virginia and North Carolina, and that mattered. And what's more, they owned seven slaves themselves. So he was convinced that they were exactly the kind of people they wanted to settle the backcountry, and he granted them hundreds of acres. They assimilated into a wealthy group of planters, and it really just didn't matter that they were – whether they were black or whether they were white.
But they started as the regulators. They had this war
right.
that they fought.
So just before the Revolution, there was a backcountry rebellion. It was a revolution before the Revolution where the ruling families of the area, they were sick and tired of really bad law enforcement, essentially. They thought there were too many people who were poaching their crops and robbing them.
It sounded pretty bad the way it was described. In
oh,
the
yeah. No, this
rape
is...
Rape and murder and pillage going on.
Right. So right. So it was a chaotic time without law enforcement, and these groups of landowners banded together and essentially went on a tear of vigilante violence. And the Gibsons were very active in the movement, and one man was a captain in the regulator movement. And he led his men directly against the colonial militia. And when the legislature debated whether he should be summarily hanged under a law called the Negro Act, which allowed basically – it sanctioned the lynching of rebellious African Americans – the legislature had a really hard time applying that law to Gideon Gibson, in part because the family had so intermarried with the powerful planter families of the backcountry that, in one man's words, they had more red and white in their faces. They were lighter skinned than half the members of the colonial legislature. And the basic sense was that they were so quintessentially powerful and free, and as a result, so quintessentially white, that to change their status would have been impossible, or at the very least unadvisable. And they moved into Mississippi and Louisiana and Kentucky. And becoming white for them was a stepping stone to rising to the heights of the planter aristocracy.
And they morphed into being white.
Yes. I mean, they by the time they moved to Mississippi, right around 1800, they were wealthy, they owned slaves, they had different, they were very proud of their heritage, but it always stopped with the generation that moved to Mississippi. They didn't know what came before. And there were some stories. Periodically, people would ask why they had a tendency towards dark complexions. And so they circulated stories about how they descended from the younger child of an English nobleman and a gypsy lass. There were stories that they descended from
Sephardic Jews
right. and Portuguese.
Right.
And they were content to take those stories at face value. And they sent their children to Yale in the 1850s, where they were just the paragons of the Southern aristocracy. And then they fought as officers in the Civil War. And after the Civil War, they became leaders of the New South. They fought very hard for the end of Reconstruction in Louisiana. And right at their moment of triumph, right when they helped broker the set of deals that led to the withdrawal of federal troops in Louisiana, you know, just a huge disaster for African Americans in Louisiana and really elsewhere in the country,
right.
too.
Killing Reconstruction.
Right. They, right at that moment, a political rival of the Gibsons, one of the descendants was in Congress as a
senator.
First he was a representative and then
right,
a senator.
Right.
And at the moment of his triumph, and the triumph of the Democratic Party, the white man's party, a political rival made very specific and pointed accusations about his bloodline. And publicly, he said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I come from old Virginia stock." And then privately, he was writing letters to local historians saying, "What are we?" And they could have easily said, "You're as white as the driven snow." But instead they said, "We think you're Portuguese Huguenots, but we can't be sure." And the family after that, they became avid genealogists. Maybe this is one reason why people in the South are so caught up with their genealogies. It's a way of really convincing yourself that you are white. And they traced their line back to this wealthy planter family in the South Carolina backcountry. And unbeknownst to them, this was this family of free people of color.
And the Gibsons you interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's interesting. 50 years ago, Winthrop Jordan, recently deceased, amazing professor at the University of Mississippi, he first revealed that Gideon Gibson, the regulator, had this serious racial ambiguity that people at the time were dealing with. And so the family has had a long time thinking about this. And you know, they're at people take different positions on it. There are all kinds of stories ranging from, you know, the story of gypsies and Portuguese and Sephardic Jews and Turkish ancestry, anything that could suggest that they were just dark white people. At the same time, there are also descendants who are really seriously thinking about what it means that they descend from free people of color.
So another family in the book that we talk about that I'm going to find this chapter in here with the another court trial that took place, the Spencers,
mm-hmm.
who are in Kentucky.
Yes.
And this is a very different scenario, but also ended up in a court. And so give us the story of the Spencers.
Sure. The Spencers, they moved into an isolated mountain community. You know what we'd call, in Tennessee, we call it an Appalachian Mountain holler, a hollow.
Right.
And they moved into this isolated community right before the Civil War. And Jordan Spencer, the patriarch of this family, was visibly dark-skinned. And he dyed his hair red, but the hair dye technology of the 1840s, 1850s isn't what it is today. And every time he sweat, his sweat would run red. And he was a manual laborer, so he was sweating all the time. So people knew he was different. His wife was a white woman, and they had children who were all named after great figures in American history. You know, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, James Monroe, Christopher Columbus. So they had a decision to make. This was a community that basically regarded itself as all white, and it was a community that really needed their neighbors. People had to count on their neighbors. People relied on their neighbors in countless ways. This was just life in the mountains. And to draw the color line, to insist that he was different, really was a tremendous cost to people. And ultimately, it was a cost they weren't willing to bear. So they all decided that Jordan Spencer was just a dark white man.
And of course, this ended up in a court suit later with
right.
the family saying, these people look very Negro. They had these Negro features. And
right. So 50 years later, for 50 years, they were hovering on the color line. They were farming and logging their mountain hollow, essentially until they went into the coal mines. And a branch of the family moved into southwestern Virginia, one of the most isolated parts of Appalachia, and essentially became involved in a mountain family feud. You know, it was something out of a silent movie, except there was a twist. So a member of the Spencer family killed someone in another family, and the other family, instead of fighting back with bullets, they fought back with rumors. And they went all around their county saying that the Spencers were black. And they got a little boy kicked, a Spencer boy kicked out of the local elementary school. And there wasn't a black elementary school. This was such a predominantly white area. There were only white schools. And then, faced with those rumors, the Spencers didn't fight back with bullets either. What they did was they hired a lawyer and in 1912 sued the other family for slander. And they wanted $10,000 in damages, which is just an astronomical sum for that time and for that place. Absolutely. And this was a trial that in the early 20th century, states had just started passing laws that were essentially the one-drop rule, that any African ancestry made a person legally black. But until then, and including this time in Virginia, different states relied on different fractions of blood. So Virginia, for a very long time, was a one-quarter rule. So if you had a black grandparent, then that made you legally black. But anything more diluted than that in your genealogy, you were legally white. And so under rules like this that relied on a black grandparent or a black great-grandparent, the people who testified in these cases were often the elderly, people in their 70s, people in their 80s, who would come into court and testify about the litigants' grandparents and great-grandparents. You know, what they looked like, how they acted, what their reputation in the community was. And that's what happened in this case. A lot of 80-year-old Appalachian farmers
talked for the Spencers.
Right, took the stand, and they were neighbors. And what's really interesting is, I mean, in at this moment, this was the high water mark of lynching in the U.S. This was the time when the landscape was changing, where whites only blacks only signs were punctuating the landscape. This was the dawn of Jim Crow. You would expect that people would be absolutely committed to the color line. And instead, you have person after person saying, oh, their race is none of my business, or how would I know what they are? And so you had some very protective neighbors and people who just weren't willing to sacrifice a life of experience with the Spencers, a life of relying on them for these abstract political imperatives.
Now, to me, one of the most interesting families, there's two other things I want to get to here very quickly before we run out of time, is the Walls, mm-hmm. and OSB Wall.
Yep.
And in some ways, to me, the most tragic story.
Yeah, so the Walls, OSB Wall was a man who was the son of a slave master in North Carolina who never married, but he had slaves with three slave women who he owned. And he freed his children in the 1830s and sent them to southern Ohio to be raised by radical Quaker abolitionists. And they became ardent abolitionists.
But kept his slaves.
Right.
He kept the mothers as slaves.
Exactly. He kept the mothers behind. Their letters from the family in North Carolina, the slave-owning family in North Carolina, to the African-American children in Ohio saying, you know, your mother looks really wonderful. You know, she sends her regards. And so he gave his children a tremendous amount, but he also took a lot away from them. And they were these really pillars of the abolitionist community in Ohio. Two members of the family, two of the children, fought in the Massachusetts 54th. OSB Wall recruited hundreds of soldiers for the Black Union regiments and then was himself commissioned a captain, went to South Carolina, worked in the Freedmen's Bureau, and then the family moved to Washington, D.C., where they became an important part of the rising Black political class during Reconstruction. And OSB Wall, he entertained Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony at his house. His next-door neighbor was his sister and brother-in-law, John Mercer Langston, who was the dean of Howard's Law School,
right.
The first Black congressman elected from Virginia. And he raised his children, sent them to integrated schools, and he educated them and brought them up to expect a full place at the table. They had every reason to believe that this would be their world. But right when they reached adulthood, this was the end of Reconstruction, and Jim Crow just slammed a door in their faces. And Washington, the promise of an interracial world in Washington was
shattered. Like all of Reconstruction, it shattered the whole possibility of what America could have become if that era had been successful.
And an entire generation of African Americans were cast adrift. And the Wall children, when OSB Wall died in 1891, one by one, they faded into the white world.
I mean, that one, the daughter who became the mother of the woman that you write about in the book,
mm-hmm.
who was kicked out of school because they found out she was black. You know, she physically could have passed for white. They found out she was black, and they kicked her out of school. And her daughter is the woman who I found to be a very interesting woman.
Yes. So I interviewed a woman whose mother in 1909 went to Brookland Elementary School in a neighborhood in D.C. right by Catholic University. And she was kicked out of the first grade because rumors started flying that she actually was African American. And her father, who was OSB Wall's son, sued the D.C. public schools. And he challenged the constitutionality of a segregated education statute. But he didn't say that segregation was wrong. It was a challenge that essentially said that the state just hadn't, or the territory, hadn't proved that his daughter wasn't white. It was a challenge to the process. And it was a curious thing. His siblings had all passed for white easily enough, and he could have moved away and just changed their names. This wasn't something that was terrifically difficult. I think by suing, it turned a bright spotlight onto him and his family. Newspapers nationwide reported about the case. Washington papers listed the block that the family lived on. And I think it really was a sign of his ambivalence about becoming white. This lawsuit essentially was doomed because his parents had been such prominent African Americans in the district. And so at the most, the hearings that were held became the final occasions when his parents were publicly memorialized. And the case was decided against them. And then they just promptly picked up stakes, and he did what his other siblings were doing. And they changed their name from Wall to Gates, and they essentially became Irish.
So, in conclusion, there are two things. One is that none of the people that you interviewed, even those who embraced their past, decided to be their past.
No one checked a box saying African American.
Right.
You know, there were people have engaged on it with this in different ways. So there's some people who give talks to African American groups talking about their family experience. But no, it's true. I think everyone still identifies as white. Maybe how they identify just matters less in today's world. And people are so caught up in their own daily lives that maybe they haven't had the occasion to really think globally about this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. It's really a hard issue for people to wrap their minds around.
Yeah.
And it really shows to me just how important race has remained even in the 21st century.
So I'm curious where this has taken you.
In the
research, the book, where you started and how it's changed your thinking about the notion of race in America. Not notional, but race in America defines our country.
Sure. So, you know, I began as an Afro-American studies major. That was the name of the department then. You pretty much buy into the view that race is a social construction, something you hear all the time. And one thing that was really interesting to me was 100 years ago, 125 years ago, people were saying almost exactly the same thing. And they would say race is a legal fiction. Race is just a social fiction. And what was interesting to me was these were people who were ardent segregationists.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that it showed me was this idea that race is a social construction is not necessarily valenced in a way that pushes us towards racial justice, that we have to have something more precise in our thinking about black and white. And for me, what this research has really pushed me towards is something that W.E.B. Du Bois said. He said, "People ask me, what is a black man? And I say that's an easy question. The black man's the person who has to ride the Jim Crow car through Georgia," meaning that these racial categories are really bare proxies for hierarchy and discrimination. That and these categories of black and white are not about blood, because after all, plenty of white people, really millions of white people, have black blood, and they're not passing for white. These are just white people. And understanding our literal kinship, understanding just how central the African American experience is to the American experience generally, and understanding how these racial categories really represent above all a very specific historical legacy of discrimination. I think all of this is crucial if we're going to move ahead as a nation.
It adds credence to the way I start off some speeches with people. When I talk about who we are as Americans, I say, if you're American, American. It adds just a whole new level to that thought. Daniel Sharfstein, thank you so much. Really pleasure to meet you.
Great to meet you, Mark.
The Invisible Line, Three American Families, and the Secret Journey from Black to White. And if you're listening to the sound of our voices right now, stay in your car and go to the Enoch Pratt Free Library and meet Daniel Sharfstein. He'll be speaking there at 7 o'clock this evening. So go from here to there and continue the conversation. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's good. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.